This is the first day of this November 2010 seven-day session. And we're going to spend these first few days reading from an old book, one of the first Zen texts translated into English, called The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. His name is Chang Chen Chi. This is one of the few books on Zen that translated into English that Roshi Kaplow had available for Taisho. So I heard it often when I was working with him, under him, and haven't used it much since then. I see from my notation that the last time we read from this was 3 years ago. And I'm going to start with the Chan master Hanshan. Chan, of course, is the Chinese word for Zen, so I'll use Chan, dealing with a Chinese master. We're going to start with his autobiography. It's one of the longer autobiographies of the masters that I'm aware of. He was born in 1545, and just to give some orientation as to what was going on in the Western Hemisphere at that time, and Europe, this was the time of Shakespeare and also the greatest works of Michelangelo. The University of Berlin was founded during Hanshan's lifetime, and work was begun on the Mexico City Cathedral. Empiezan a construir la Catedral de Mexico City. And it begins, this is all in first person. I was born, I'll do some editing here because it gets into some detail that I can just summarize. Like, I was born near Nanjing. My mother, a pious Buddhist, had been a worshiper of the all-merciful Kuan Yin all her life, Kanon. One day she dreamed that Kuan Yin brought into the house a child which she received with warm embraces. As a result, she became pregnant, and on the 12th of October, 1545, I was born. See, already, right from the beginning, right, the first paragraph, there is this element of the superstitious that seems to be more common in Chinese Zen than in Japanese Zen. So she had this dream, and as a result, last time I checked, that didn't happen from dreams. The legend of the Buddha's birth was the same, that Queen Maya touched a blossom or something, and an elephant was there, and next thing we knew that Siddhartha was born. In 1546, when I was 12 months old, a serious illness carried me to the point of death. My mother prayed to Kanon and vowed that if I recovered, she would offer me to the monastery to become a monk. When I did recover, she duly enlisted my name in the Monastery of Longevity. That's the name of the monastery. It was presumably a local monastery. In China, there's such a strong longing for a long life. I mean, explicitly, we all long for a long life, but this is more explicit and more more widely acknowledged, I think, than in many countries. In Taoism, you have this ideal of the immortals. And so it's not surprising that there would be a monastery called the Monastery of Longevity. It was very common in the 16th century China for a parent to bring a child, turn a child over to a monastery, either because of poverty, or they just could not support the child, or in addition, usually to other children, or for other reasons, like this one. But this is, so far, his mother had just registered his name there, so he was still living at home. When I was 3 years old, I preferred to sit alone and did not care to play with the other children. My grandfather would always exclaim, "This child is like a wooden pole." That would be a promising sign for someone who went on to become a Zen master. When I was seven, my mother sent me to school. At that time, I had an uncle who loved me very much. One day, just before I arrived home from school, he died. When I saw him lying so still on the bed, my mother tried to deceive me about his death. She said, "Your uncle is asleep. You might wake him up." Whereupon, I called to my uncle a few times, but he did not answer me. Suddenly, my aunt, very grief-stricken, cried out to him, "Oh, my heaven, where have you gone?" Where have you gone? Who among us who have been at the deathbed, at the side of someone when they die, has not had this question in some form grip us? Where have you gone? I was very puzzled, and I said to my mother, "My uncle is lying right here. Why does my aunt say he has gone away?" And then my mother said, "Your uncle is dead." I asked her, "If one dies, where does one then go?" We don't have him recounting an answer from her, but he says that from that moment, this question was deeply impressed on my mind. So this had a great impact on him. He was seven at the time. I think sometimes we can all too easily forget that this is really the very core of what Zen practice offers, is an insight into the nature of life and death. And to be a human being means at some point or points in one's life to have these questions come up. Where will I go after I die? Where was I before I was born? What are we all doing here, moving through this life together, only to eventually pass away? What is the point of it all? What is it all for? These are the fundamental questions that fuel any really authentic spiritual practice. Many religions have done everything they can to snuff out these questions by providing their answers, their pat answers. If you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. Well, thank you for that. After some time, my aunt gave birth to a child. When my mother took me to see the newborn baby for the first time, I asked, "How did this baby get into the belly of my aunt?" My mother patted me and said, "Foolish child, how did you get into my belly?" So she knew that sometimes the best response to a question is a rhetorical answer. "From that day on," he says, "I was obsessed with the question of life and death. It stuck in my mind and weighed like lead on my heart." I wonder how common this is. How many people here, say, have had the memory of having the matter of the certainty of one's death and the uncertainty of the time of one's death weigh on you? And if so, how long was it? Was it just a short time? An hour or two, a day or two, a month, years? When I first came to the center, I realized that my main fear was that I would die before coming to awakening. It was something of an obsession. But it was great motivation for practice. I felt like I was running against the clock. This was my chance. When I was 8, I was boarded in the home of some relatives across the river so that I could be nearer my school. My mother forbade me to come home more often than once a month. But one day I refused to return to school after my monthly holiday. When I told my mother that I could not bear to leave her, she became furious. She slapped me and chased me to the riverbank. But there I would not leave her to board the ferry. In a rage, my mother grabbed me by the hair, threw me into the river, and then turned back home without once looking back. My grandmother, who was nearby, called for help, and I was saved. Finally, when I reached home, my mother exclaimed, "What is the use of keeping this trash alive? It would be better if he had drowned." After this, she beat me and tried to chase me away. Then I decided that my mother was too stern and cruel and that henceforth I would not go home anymore. So this is when he was 8. Can you imagine? But now here's the other side. I later learned that my mother many times stood alone on the riverbank weeping. When my grandmother heard of this, she scolded her. With tears flowing down her cheeks, my mother answered, "I must make him overcome his too affectionate nature so that he can study seriously." Now, a little backstory here. The highest aspiration in China at the time was to become a government official. And, of course, the higher the better. But that required education, and it was fiercely competitive. You had to study hard, to put it mildly, and then you had to do very well in these absolutely crucial civil examinations. After all your years of studying, then came the test that determined the course of your life. If you passed, then you could enter this immense bureaucracy of ancient China, and then with a lot more hard work, advance up the ladder. So, like so many parents, what she wanted of him was that he go as far as he could, of course. But if what he reports actually happened, then I think we might be dealing with some mental illness here with his mother. It wouldn't be the first serious Zen practitioner who had a mother with emotional problems. I have this hypothesis going that I have no way of trying to verify, but that many people who get very seriously into spiritual practice have a very close connection to their mother, and that the mother is sometimes, how shall we put this, has some real problems. It doesn't matter. When I was 9, I entered the monastery to study. So that would be what you do at first at 9 years old. Is it's kind of a school. You study the sutras, Buddhist texts, maybe other things too. These monasteries, they could be just huge, and as those of you who were in China recently, as part of the Zen Center pilgrimage, some of you know that they're like great universities in size, and as part of their many functions, they would have schools for children, and certainly even it would certainly provide Buddhist education for those who are on a track to becoming ordained. So he entered the monastery to study. One day, I overheard a monk reciting the Sutra of Avalokiteshvara, of Kanon. Thus I became aware that Kuan Yin could save us from all the sufferings of this world. At this realization, I became very excited and borrowed the sutra so that I might read and study it privately. Later, when I had accompanied my mother while she burned incense and made prostrations to Kuan Yin, I said, "Do you know the Sutra of the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin?" My mother said, "No." This is a reminder that certainly in China you could be a very devout practitioner without being able to read. You the most common practice when I was there was burning incense. You'd see these women, usually when I was there, it was women bringing these bundles of incense and lighting the incense and doing prostrations. But as we see here, they wouldn't necessarily have read or be familiar with even the 10-verse Kanon Sutra. That's the short version that we chant here. So she said no, that she didn't know the sutra, whereupon I immediately recited the sutra for her. This pleased her very much, and she asked, "Where did you learn this?" For the manner and voice in which I recited the sutra were just like that of the old monk that he had heard reciting it. In 1555, I was 10. My mother was pressing me so hard to study that I was unhappy about it. "Why should I study?" I asked her. "To get a position in the government," she replied. "And what kind of position can I have later in the government?" I asked. Mother said, "You can start in a low position, and it is possible to rise to become even prime minister." "Even if I become prime minister, what then?" "Well, that's as far as one can go." And then he said, "What is the use of becoming a high government official? To toil all one's life and get nothing is futile. I want to obtain something of eternal value." My mother exclaimed, "Oh, a useless son like you can be nothing but a wandering monk." I asked, "What good is it to become a monk?" "A monk," she said, "is a disciple of the Buddha and can go anywhere in the world. He is a man of true freedom. Everywhere people will give him offerings and serve him." "This seems very good to me. I should like to be a monk." And my mother replied, "I'm afraid that you have no such merits." Boy, with friends like his mother, who needs enemies? When I appeared surprised at this, my mother continued, "There have been many champion scholars in the world, but Buddhas and patriarchs do not often appear." "I have such merit," I insisted, "but I was afraid you would not let me go ahead." "If you have such merit," my mother replied, "I will let you go your way." This promise of hers I cherished in my heart. One day when I was 11, several persons wearing bamboo rain hats with carrying poles upon their shoulders approached our house. At once I asked my mother, "Who are these people?" "They are traveling monks," she replied. I was delighted and observed them most carefully. When they had nearly reached our house, they put down their carrying poles and rested under a tree nearby. They asked us where they could find some food. My mother told them to wait and immediately began preparing a meal for them, attending and serving them with great respect and veneration. After eating, the monks stood up and shouldered their poles, but raised only one hand to express their thanks. My mother waved them off, saying, "Please don't thank me." The monks departed without uttering a word. So then I said to my mother, "These monks seem impolite. They didn't even say thank you, but just left." My mother explained, "If they had thanked me, I would have obtained less merit from this good deed." I then said to myself privately that their actions showed the supremacy of the priesthood. This encounter encouraged me more strongly than ever in my decision to become a monk. The only obstacle was that I did not then have the opportunity. I'm not sure what he means by that. But you see here, he was appreciative of the prestige that came from being a monk. This wouldn't have hurt his aspiration. When I was in Japan training for a period of months, one of the other guys at the temple, an American actually, told me that the two most prestigious occupations in Japan at the time were a physician and a Buddhist priest. I don't think that's the case anymore. I've heard over and over again from different sources that Zen is very much on the decline there. They can't begin to man the temples. Every week, I've heard there's another temple closing in Japan. So that wouldn't suggest that there's any much prestige to being a Zen priest. In 1557, I was 12. Usually, I didn't like to mingle with worldly people or take part in their affairs. Whenever my father tried to arrange a marriage for me, this would have been the custom at the time, the arranged marriages, I stopped him at once. One day I heard a monk from the capital say that in the monastery of Pao En lived a great master named Shi Lin. Immediately I wanted to go see him. I asked my father's permission to go, but he refused. Then I asked my mother to intercede for me. She reasoned, "It is better to let our son follow his own wish and to help him to accomplish it." That October, I was sent to the monastery. As soon as the Grand Master saw me, he was pleased, remarking, "This boy is an unusual person. It would be a pity if he became an ordinary monk, or only an ordinary monk." At that time, Master Wu Qi was preaching a sutra in the monastery. The Grand Master brought me to the meeting. When Master Ta Chao Chao saw me, he was delighted and exclaimed, "This child will become the master of humans and devas." He then patted me and asked, "Would you rather be a high officer in the government or a Buddha?" I answered, "A Buddha, of course." Then he turned to the others, saying, "We must not underrate this child. He should be well educated." Although I did not understand a word of the lecture while I was listening to it, my heart became eager and fervent as if it knew something but could not express it in words. It would have been a lot just the company there. While he was listening to the lecture, being sitting in the Buddha hall with all the other monks, he must have felt like he had really come home. When I was 19, many of my friends gained honor by passing the official examination. My friends urged me to take the examination too. When Master Yun Ku heard of this, he became worried that I might be persuaded to engage in worldly affairs. So he encouraged me to practice religion and to strive for Zen. He related to me many stories of the masters of the past and showed me the book called The Biographies of the Great Monks. Before I had finished reading The Life of Chung Feng, I was so moved and exalted that I sighed to myself, saying, "Oh, this is what I would like to do." Thereupon, I made up my mind to devote my life to the Dharma. I then asked the Grand Master to ordain me. Discarding all worldly affairs and learning, I devoted myself to the practice of Zen, but could not get anywhere. Notice here, discarding all worldly affairs and learning. So already now he had vaulted over the study that this master had wanted to see him undertake. He wanted the practice, the thing itself. Then I concentrated on reciting the name of Buddha Amida day and night without interruption. here too, another explanation. In these Chinese monasteries, they weren't, or many of them weren't exclusively Zen or Pure Land. They weren't exclusively of one sect. So they would have the Zen school of the monastery, the Zen division of the monastery, and they would have the Pure Land division of the monastery, and they would and that you could move from apparently from different from one practice to the next. So here he was trying the standard practice in the Pure Land school, which is to recite the name of a certain Buddha, Buddha Amida. And this, he said, he did day and night without interruption. Before long, he said, Buddha Amida appeared before me in a dream, sitting high in the sky in the direction of the setting sun. So that is the that was the first of a whole bunch of unusual experiences, mystical experiences this Hanshan had, some of which he relates in this account. There are too many of them to read them all. I don't think that it's helpful to read about one exotic experience after another that he had. We don't set store by this in Zen. Even the most inspiring visions that we might have in our practice, we want to avoid clinging to. We want to leave it behind. If it happens, it happens. If it's inspiring, that's wonderful. It's a great, great blessing to have an experience like that, as long as we don't cling to it. In that respect, it's like Makkyo. In that respect, it can be considered a kind of high-level Makkyo. So here, where he sees this Buddha appearing up in the sky in the direction of the west, the setting sun. The west, the significance of the west is that it's, according to this, in this school, the Pure Land school, this Buddha Amida is the Buddha of the Western Paradise. And if you recite this formula of, with the Buddha's name, then you might, end up, in, after death of, reaching the Western Paradise. It sounds a little like becoming Prime Minister. So during this, my reading of this account, I'm going to be skipping over some of these, well, frankly, bizarre experiences he relates. I remember when Roshi Kapil, he'd read it from beginning to end, including all of the bizarre experiences, and I remember being confused. What am I supposed to do with this? You know, he sees through walls, and he does this, and he does that, and anyway, it just makes it too long if I read every bizarre thing that happens to this guy. That winter, our monastery invited the master Wu Qi to teach the philosophy of Huayan. That's another major school of Buddhism, is the Huayan school that has at its core the Avatamsaka Sutra. So there's the Zen school, there's the Pure Land school, and there's the Huayan school. When the lecture came to the point of the 10 mysterious gates, that is, the eternal realm of the ocean seal, I realized the infinite and all-inclusive totality of the universe. I was so impressed with a profound admiration for Qing Liang, that's the founder of the Huayan sect, that I adopted one of his names and called myself Qing Yin. I then put my understanding before the master Wu Qi. He said to me, "Oh, so you wish to follow the path of Huayan. Good. But do you know why he called himself Qing Liang, which means pure and cool? It was because he used to dwell on the Qing Liang mountain, cool in summer and icy and frozen in winter. From then on, whether walking or standing still, I always saw before me a fantasy world of ice and snow. I then made up my mind to go and dwell on that mountain. Nothing in the world could attract me anymore. The yearning to renounce this world arose continuously within me. He has such a strong monastic karma, doesn't he? It's so obvious. When I was 20, my grandmaster died. Grand would be the supreme teacher of the monastery, among other teachers. A few days before his death, he summoned all the monks in the monastery and said, "I am now 83. Very soon I will be leaving this world. I have some 80 disciples, but the one who will carry on my work is Hanshan. After my death, you should all obey his orders and not neglect his injunctions just because of his age." He was 20 at the time. On the seventh day of the new year, my grandmaster, wearing his formal clothing, called each monk into his own room to say goodbye. All of us were much surprised by this action. 3 days later, he settled his affairs and made his will. At the time, he appeared to have only a slight illness. We took him some medicine, but he refused it, saying, "I am going away. What is the use of taking drugs?" Then he summoned all the monks in the monastery and asked them to recite the name of Buddha Amida for him. We prayed for him 5 days and nights, and with his rosary in hand, he died in the sitting posture, peacefully reciting the name of Buddha Amida. Not long after his death, the room in which he had lived for 30 years was destroyed by fire, as if to give an omen to his followers. Well, you know, the next paragraph is about a whole page long, so let's stop now and resume tomorrow and recite the four vows now.